All right, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 639 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In today's podcast, I'm going to start what I call a USMLE specs series. This is going to be series one. There is about 86 questions that I'm going to go through, and I'm going to go through 10 in each podcast for the most part, you know, within reason. And you may wonder, like, where did you get this from, Divine? Well, this is something if you do like search for USMLE specs, they have like these very good step 2 CK, step 3 like questions that's on their website. There's 86 of them. They're very good. So I will say this podcast is certainly for a person studying for step 1, for step 2 CK or step 3. It's almost like doing another free 120. And I'm going to go through every single question, why the right answers are right and why the wrong answers are wrong. And I'm going to post a PDF of this document in the with the podcast as well. All right, so let's do question number one. So a 14-year-old girl who has received 3 courses of chemotherapy for Hodgkin's disease is brought to the office by her father because of worsening cough, shortness of breath, a low-grade fever and fatigue for the past 2 days. No one at home is ill. She says she's taking no medications, her vaccinations are up to date, she attends a private school. Vital signs are temperature of 98.8, pulse is 100 per minute, respirations at 35 per minute, and blood pressure is 110 over 72. Oxygen saturation on pulse ox is 87% while breathing room air. Physical examination discloses a few coarse breath sounds in the lower lobes and retractions. Chest x-ray shows no masses and a mild interstitial pattern. No infiltrates or effusions are noted, and heart size is normal. Which of the following is the most appropriate step at this time? Right? Again, before you jump to the answers, just look at this question, what's going on, right? So this person is on chemo. Your person's on chemo, you're probably immunocompromised, right? And then this person seems to have a lot of pulmonary symptoms. And we're told that you get a chest radiograph and you see interstitial infiltrates, right? Again, if you're just looking in terms of disease scripts, this looks an awful lot like PCP pneumonia, right? So we're going to try to find the answer that tags along with that. So probably going to go ahead and pick option A here, right? Option A says, admit the girl to the hospital for high dose TMPSMX therapy, right? That's the smart play here. You know, option B says, begin isoniazid therapy in the girl and test the family for TB. No, right? No, this person doesn't have TB. TB usually is going to show up with cavitary infiltrates in the lungs on imaging. We don't see that here. And you're going to have symptoms that are like weight loss, you know, night sweats and all those things, you know, those B symptoms, we don't see those. Prescribe Cipro. I don't think that's a very smart idea for a kid, right? You don't want to rupture their Achilles. And remember, Cipro being a fluoroquinolone also does things like prolong the QT interval. Right? And then prescribe oral fluconazole. That's something we're going to do if we're worried about like oral candidiasis. This person doesn't have oral candidiasis or esophageal candidiasis, right? This person is not presenting with dysphagia, so that'll be wrong. And then option E says schedule a lung biopsy. No, that's ridiculous. That's frankly insane, right? So good teaching point to keep in mind here is the USMLEs, they're becoming very big these days on giving PCP pneumonia to non-HIV patients, right? So like, for example, people that are immunocompromised because they have like some immunodeficiency disease, or they're taking some immunocompromising drug like steroids or TNF inhibitors or chemotherapy, things like that. All right. Now, question number two says, a 14-year-old African-American girl comes to the office for the first time for a sports physical examination. She's asymptomatic. Her medical history is unremarkable. Family history shows that her maternal grandmother had an MI at age 65. Her mother has hypertension that is well controlled with antihypertensive medication. Vital signs are a temperature of 99, pulse is 86, respirations are 16 per minute, and blood pressure is 112 over 74. She is 165 centimeters tall, so she's 5'5". She's at the 75th percentile, weight is 45 kilograms, so 99 pounds, 25th percentile. Physical exam shows a grade 2 to 3 out of 6 systolic murmur at the left sternal border. The second heart sound, S2, is loud with fixed splitting and is heard best in the second left intercostal space. The family is anxious and requests an answer regarding the patient's sports participation. Which of the following is the most appropriate advice to give the patient and her parents? Right. So option A says, allow her to participate in all sports. Option B says, allow her to participate in non-contact sports only. Option C says, allow her to participate in sports but recommend cardiac cath. Option D says, allow her to participate in sports but recommend echocardiography. Option E says, prescribe prophylactic antibiotics for use prior to each game. All right, so what's going on here, right? So we see this girl, right? She seems otherwise normal, but she seems to have all these valvular issues, right? All these murmurs, you know, seems like she's got an ASD, seems like she's potentially got a VSD as well, right? The ASD, the white fake split, right? And then we're seeing a loud second heart sound. So that's kind of worrisome that, hey, she's developing like pulmonary hypertension here, right? But she's pretty normal, right? Like literally like 60% of the question is telling us normal, 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 right? So don't go for a gangbusters answer here. That'll be pretty ridiculous, right? So for this girl, I think I'm going to go with option D here, right? Allowed to participate in sports, but recommend echocardiography, right? Like she's got a murmurs. You got to evaluate those. And remember, it's not every murmur you evaluate with an echo, right? But this person has concerning features, right? So remember, what are the things we evaluate by echocardiography murmur-wise? Well, if you have a murmur that is 3 out of 6 systolic or greater, this person checks that box, right? If you have a diastolic murmur, you should also get it evaluated. If you have a symptomatic murmur, you should get that evaluated. If you have a holosystolic murmur, you should get that evaluated. So, you know, this person has a, or if you have a murmur associated with a complication, like a person developing a stroke or whatever, you should get that evaluated with echocardiography as well, right? So this girl for sure needs an echo, right? But she's fine. She can probably do sports. You're not going to like not be able to do sports because you have like an ASD or VSD, right? But yeah, like you need to evaluate this murmur because she definitely has an indication for a kind of a strange, she has an echocardiographic indication for a murmur, right? And again, you know, remember we do prophylactic antibiotics to put that have like unresolved cyanotic congenital heart defects, right? For endocarditis, she doesn't meet that criteria. And ASD or VSD is not cyanotic, right? A VSD is cyanotic though when you develop Eisenmenger's, right? And then cardiac cath, you do that when you're worried about like coronary artery disease, right? She doesn't seem to have that. And again, non-contact sports, remember that's something we do with people that have mono, right? Mono, so they don't rupture their spleen. We tell them that, hey, about four weeks after, wait for 4 weeks before you start doing contact sports, actually, sorry. That non-contact sports is a very good distractor there, right? Then remember, people that have Marfans as well should also be careful of contact sports so they don't explode their aorters. All right. And then, yeah, she should be allowed to participate in all sports, but you got to evaluate that murmur. So A is wrong. All right. So items number 3 and 4. So an 81-year-old woman is being prepared for discharge following a 3-week stay in the hospital for repair of a fractured hip that she sustained while gardening. She now ambulates with difficulty using a walker, but she's determined to become independent again and to return to her own home. Her daughter, who is in the room with the patient, says, "I want to take mother home with me because I'm concerned that she could fall and break her hip again." Mom says she doesn't really want to leave her own home, but she will do what is best. The daughter turns to her mother and says firmly, "Isn't that right, Mom?" The mother says, "Yes, I guess so," averting eye contact with both her daughter and you by looking down toward the floor. Danger, 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 danger. What does this sound like? Elderly abuse, right? Elderly abuse, elderly abuse. But hey, let's look at the actual question. Question 3 says, which of the following is the most appropriate response to the mother? Excuse me. Option A says, are you sure you want to go home with your daughter? Option B says, how do you feel if you fell again and had another fracture? Option C says, is this really your decision or is it your daughter's? Option D says, I would like to talk with you in private now. Option E says, you are lucky you have a daughter who wants to take care of you, right? We see this question just presents some interesting conundrums, right? Mom wants to go home. Daughter is like, hey, come live with me, right? And then the elderly mom is like avoiding eye contact, looking towards the ground, saying, yes, I guess so, right? This looks like elderly abuse. And elderly abuse, if you have any suspicion, you have to evaluate it. You got to report it, right? So obviously, I would really, really hope you're saying that divine. The right answer probably should be option D, right? Because you're removing the mom from the situation and evaluating, like to just check, like, hey, let me just kind of dig into this a little bit more. Is this lady being abused or what, right? And then option E says, you are lucky to have a daughter who wants to take care of you. Yeah, it's good to have kids that want to take care of you in your old age, but you got to evaluate that elderly abuse thing first, right? C says, is this really your decision or is it your daughter's? Ultimately, it's the mom's decision, right? Because she's lucid, right? So it is her decision. Like there's clarity on that already. Option B says, how would you feel if you fell again and had another fracture, you're guilt tripping your patients, right? Don't build these guilting your patients answers. And then option A says, are you sure you want to go home with your daughter? Well, she has communicated a decision, right? You can see that she's reluctant, but is like, in the heat of the moment, she said what she gotta say, right? But we're worried about elderly abuse, so we need to do something about that. And then question 4 says, which of the following is most likely to prevent another fall and a possible fracture in this patient? Option A says, advise her to walk only when accompanied by an adult. Option B says, ensure that she does not have orthostatic hypotension. Option C says, provide her with assistance for activities of daily living. Option D says, provide her with an electric wheelchair. Option E says, request a visiting nurse to assess the safety of her living in, environment. Right. So what should you pick here? So again, here's the thing, right? Whenever a person has a high risk of a fall, right? You always want to evaluate factors in their lives that may lead to them falling, right? Is it like polypharmacy, or do they have like an unsafe home, right? Or do they have like a musculoskeletal disorder where strength training may be helpful or whatever, right? You got to do a fall risk assessment, right? That's one of the smart things to do. You got to do a fall risk assessment, right? It's just kind of like when a, this is like a completely unrelated point, but it's kind of related. You know, in the USMLEs, you see like a disaster that happens, like a natural disaster or whatever, right? And then they ask you like, what's the most important initial public health response. You want to pick the answer that talks about doing a needs assessment, right? Do a needs assessment. Like, hey, what's going on first before you start doing all these interventions, right? So I will say option E is the best answer here, is the best answer here, right? Option D, provide her with an electric wheelchair, is not a good idea because, you know, she can start having DVTs and PEs and all those problems. If you can get her moving, I think you should. And this lady can ambulate. We see in the question, she now ambulates with difficulty using a walker. So at least she can ambulate. Don't just give up on that and make the person non-ambulatory. No. And then option C says, provide her with assistance for activities of daily living. This person just struggles with walking, not with activities of daily living. So that's wrong. Option B says, ensure that she does not have orthostatic hypotension. Well, there's nothing in this question that tells us about orthostasis, right? So it's like, why make that leap of faith? Don't make leaps of faith on your exam. That's not a smart testing strategy. And then option A says, advise her to walk only when accompanied by an adult. No, this lady doesn't need to be accompanied by an adult, right? You're placing severe, significant limitations on her life. Don't do that. That's going to be wrong on your exams. All right. Now, question number 5 says, a 27-year-old Mexican woman, gravida 4, para 2, aborto 1, who is at 25 weeks gestation, comes to the ED because of painless vaginal bleeding that she noticed 2 hours ago after sexual intercourse. Wow, that must have been intense. After sexual intercourse with her husband. Sorry, just kidding. All right. The patient has not received routine prenatal care during her pregnancy, though she was treated for chlamydia with azithromycin at 15 weeks gestation. She gave birth to both of her daughters at home in Mexico via normal vaginal delivery. She had one spontaneous abortion at 5 weeks gestation. Vital signs are temperature of 37 degrees Celsius, which is 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse of 100 per minute, respirations at 24 per minute, blood pressure is 110 over 64. Sterile speculum examination shows 4 milliliters of blood in the vaginal vault. The cervix appears closed. Ultrasonography of the pelvis is most likely to show which of the following causes of bleeding in this patient, right? So again, this question is talking about painless vaginal bleeding, right? Again, don't overthink this thing. This is painless vaginal bleeding in a person that is pretty close to the end of the second trimester slash early third trimester, right? So this, she's more in the second trimester, but she's pretty late in the second trimester, right? So painless vaginal bleeding, right? So we know that, hey, if you're talking about painless vaginal bleeding, you're talking about the previas. The previas are painless, right? But the placental abruption, the uterine rupture, those are painful, right? So you can probably get rid of option, you know, because option A says cervicitis, option B says placenta accreta, option C says placenta previa, option D says placental abruption, option E says preterm labor, right? Option E makes no sense. This is not preterm labor. This lady is not having contractions. That's wrong. Option D says placental abruption. That causes painful vaginal bleeding. That's wrong. Option C says placenta previa. That causes painless vaginal bleeding. That's a pretty good answer. Option B says placenta accreta. Placenta accreta is like a labor complication, right? You're trying to yank out the placenta, it's not coming out. That's not what's going on here, right? That's not what's going on here, right? And we don't see placenta accreta having like an association with, oh, you just had sexual intercourse, right? So that's wrong. Option A, cervicitis. Cervicitis is going to have a longer timeline than just 2 hours ago, right? So the right answer is going to be option C, right? Remember, placenta previa is when you have your placental vessels overlying the cervical os, right? So if, you know, you're having sexual intercourse and The person's penis like slams those placental vessels that can cause like some mild bleeding. It's typically going to be inconsequential, right? But the thing is, when a woman has placenta previa, you know, sometimes we recommend like pelvic rest, not bed rest, pelvic rest, basically like calm down on the sex, right, for now, so that you don't rupture those placental vessels that overlying the cervical walls and cause a profounder bleeding. All right. Now, question number six says, an 80-year-old African-American woman is brought to the office for the first time by her son because she has signs of mildly decreasing mental function. She's having increasing trouble reading, writing, and watching television. She has mild stable angina pectoris, and she had an uncomplicated MI 8 years ago. Physical examination discloses no abnormalities except for corrected visual acuity of 20 out of 200 OU, which appears to be caused by cataracts, right? Which appears to be caused by cataracts. Now, mini mental state exam score, her mini mental state examination score is 29 out of 30. Which of the following is the most correct statement about this patient's condition, right? So this person seems to be struggling with, having like some mental issues, signs of mildly decreasing mental function, but she's 80, right? Let's give her some grace. And her MMSE is 29 out of 30. Seems pretty good to me, but man, her vision is terrible. All right, so let's look at the answers. Option A says her daily activities would likely improve if she had cataract extraction with lens implantation. Okay. Option B says her diminished mental status is a contraindication for a cataract operation. Cataract operation is pretty low risk surgery. Option B makes no sense. Option C says her history of cardiac disease and advanced age are contraindications for a cataract operation. No, right? Cataract surgery is low risk surgery. This is something I teach in my social sciences and ethics class. Low risk surgery. You don't need to do any pre-op workup. You don't need even if you had like a terrible medical history, you can still do those surgeries, right? So C is wrong. Option D says her mental status should be reevaluated in 1 year. No. What if it keeps declining and worsening, right? You want to do something about it now. And then option E says you need more information to decide whether she will be helped by a cataract operation. Seriously, you need more information, right? That's this is an example of a person that is like driving up the cost of healthcare, right? This person's corrected visual acuity is 20 out of 200. That's pretty bad, right? And then this person, appears to be caused by cataracts. Cataracts is something that can be easily diagnosed with a physical exam, right? This person, if she can start seeing more, her mental faculties will probably improve, right? This person literally cannot read, cannot write, cannot watch TV because of her poor vision. Fix the poor vision, right? So her daily activities will likely improve if she had cataract extraction with lens implantation. So I'm going to go with option A for this one. All right, I'm going to go to question number seven. A 70-year-old Vietnamese fisherman is brought to the ED by his son, who says that his father has had sweats occurring. Oh, an immigrant with sweats. I wonder why. All right, let's keep going. Who says that his father has had sweats occurring twice a night, soaking his bedclothes, and a cough productive of yellow, foul-tasting fluid, and blood-tinged sputum for the past 3 weeks? His appetite has been poor for 2 months, and he has lost 26 pounds or 12 kilograms during that time. Physical examination shows an emaciated man in acute distress. He is coughing frequently and deeply. Vital signs are a temperature of 37.8 degrees Celsius, which is 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Pulse is 98 per minute, and blood pressure is 105 over 60. His respirations are shallow but not labored. Loud ronchi are heard on the right side of the chest. His liver and spleen are palpable and non-tender. His inguinal nodes are mated but non-tender. Chest x-ray is shown. Sputum smear discloses multiple neutrophils but normal flora. Appropriate diagnostic tests are completed to confirm the diagnosis. Which of the following is the most appropriate management at this time? Guys, immigrant, foreign country, night sweats, weight loss, coughing, foul smelling, blah, 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 blah. Doesn't even matter what the chest x-ray shows. What in the world do you think this is going to be? This looks an awful lot like TB, right? So we're going to go for option C here, antimicrobacterial therapy, right? Option A, antibiotic therapy is too broad, so I'm not going to pick that answer, right? Antimicrobacterial therapy is a less broad answer, and it fits the question better. Option B says antifungal therapy. Well, guys, TB is a bacteria. It's not a fungus. There's a reason why it's called mycobacteria. It's not called mycofungus, right? So option B is definitely wrong. Option D says bronchoscopy. You don't say. No, we're not going to do that. They've already done diagnostic testing. Why do a bronchoscopy? And then option E says referral to a thoracic surgeon for right upper lobectomy. Oof. Man, if we did a surgery for people that had TB. thoracic surgeons will be the wealthiest surgeons around. No, we're not going to do that. That's insane, right? All right, so let's go to question number 8. A 50-year-old man comes to the ED because of a 2-hour history of vomiting coffee ground material. He has lost 10 pounds in the past 6 months. Uh-oh. Dark blood is obtained on passing a nasogastric tube. Which of the following is the most important factor in determining this patient's long-term prognosis? Prognosis, right? Guys, the USMLEs, they love prognosis, right? And the thing is, some of these questions you can prepare for by just learning. Some of them you cannot prepare for. But again, you need to apply wisdom with these questions, right? You need to apply wisdom with these questions. I teach how to deal with prognosis questions in many of my classes, and I also go over prognosis in my classes. But option A says amount and rate of blood loss. Option B says cause of the bleeding. Option C says history of previous GI bleeding. Option D says initial hematocrit measurement. Option E says initial response to a bolus of saline. Guys, look at the question here. Which of the following is the most important factor in determining this patient's long-term prognosis, right? And the thing is, this guy, he's 50. He's coughed up blood. He's lost 10 pounds. That's kind of worrisome, right? Like if a person, think about it, just think, like a person comes to your office, they're 50 years old. They just coughed up, they just vomited blood, right? And the person has lost some weight. What is like the first thing you should be worried about? I'd hope you're thinking about cancer, right? And then look at this, say, which of the following is the most important factor in determining this patient's long-term prognosis? Well, obviously for this person, you probably want to go ahead and do like some kind of EGD with biopsy, right? At least do an EGD just to make sure like, hey, why did this person cough up this stuff, right? Like, is he H. pylori where it's like, we can be like, whew, we can heave a sigh of relief, right? Or is he like esophageal cancer, gastric cancer, something kind of bad, right? Because obviously if it's like peptic ulcer disease or H. pylori that's causing his problem, or, you know, esophageal candidiasis causing his problem, then hey, we're not too worried, right? Those are pretty low-key conditions, right? Prognosis is pretty good for those. Long-term, remember the question is asking about long-term. But if it's cancer, right? Like esophageal cancer typically has a terrible prognosis. Gastric cancer usually has a terrible prognosis, right? So the cause of the bleeding makes the most sense here, right? Because again, that's the thing that relates more to the long-term prognosis, right? Again, this question is not asking about short-term prognosis. So option A doesn't make much sense. Amount and rate of blood loss. No, they're not asking about short term here. They're asking about long term, right? In the short term, how much you bleed, yeah, determines your prognosis. But long term, it's probably not going to be a big issue, right? It's probably not going to be a big issue. And then option C says history of previous GI bleeding. Maybe that tells us, okay, this may be what your risk of another re-bleed looks like, but you know, it doesn't really tell us about your long-term prognosis. Initial hematocrit measurement, right? It tells us, again, it's a short-term thing. Hey, if your hematocrit is pretty low and you have a GI bleed, you've probably bled a lot to start, right? Probably tells us that, ooh, this person's GI bleeding was intense, right? But again, doesn't tell us much long-term, right? And then initial response to a bolus of saline, again, that's a short-term answer. That doesn't line up with a question asking about long-term prognosis. All right, now I'm going to go to questions 9 and 10. They're co-joined questions, right? So a 22-year-old African-American woman, Gravida 1 para 1, is evaluated in the maternity ward of the hospital 24 hours after giving birth to a 4,267-gram, that's a 9-pound, 7-ounce male infant, via uncomplicated vaginal delivery. Following delivery, she underwent repair of a 4th-degree perineal laceration. She is currently able to walk to the bathroom and void without difficulty, but she has not had a bowel movement since delivery. Medical history is otherwise unremarkable, and her only medications are prenatal vitamins. Vital signs are a temperature of 99 degrees Fahrenheit, pulse is 68 per minute, respirations are 18 per minute, and blood pressure is 128 over 86. The uterus is palpable to the level of the umbilicus. The vaginal laceration is not inflamed or swollen. Sutures are intact, and there is drainage from the site. There is no drainage from the site, sorry. Lochia is normal. Hemoglobin concentration is 10.8. grams per deciliter. The patient states that she is concerned about her insurance company requirement that she stay in the hospital no longer than 48 hours postpartum. She is worried that she will not be ready to leave tomorrow as she is breastfeeding and needs more help from the nurses. She also is concerned about her bowel function and wants to stay until she is sure it will be normal. She asks if you would extend her stay to 72 hours postpartum if she is not ready to leave tomorrow. All right, so here's the thing. Right. This question is long, but again, thankfully, it's basically like one stem for two questions, right? That's probably why they are okay making the question this long, right? And then question 9 says, which of the following is the most appropriate response to her request? Option A says, I'm sure the insurance company will understand if you need another day, so you take whatever time you need before you go home. Option B says, let me decide whether or not it is too soon for you to leave the hospital. Option C says, let's see how you feel tomorrow and we can discuss the most appropriate time to leave then. Option D says, you concentrate on getting better and leave the insurance company to me. Hero doctor. Okay. Option E says, unfortunately, I have no control over the insurance company, so you had better plan on leaving tomorrow, right? This is an ethics question, right? And again, what's the right answer here, right? So option A, I'm sure the insurance company will understand. you don't know insurance companies in America. All right. They will understand if you need another day. It'll take whatever time you need. No, that is not a good use of, actually, that's a terrible answer. That's not a good use of healthcare resources, right? Like, if we let patients take as much time as they need, patients can really take some time or take too little time, right? No, you need to balance all the information available. Option A is wrong. Option B says, let me decide whether or not it is too soon for you to leave the hospital. See, shared decision making is a concept the USMLEs love, right? Let me decide. No, you give recommendations, but you need to get some consent from the patient. So option B is wrong. Option C says, hey, let's see how you feel tomorrow, right? This is just 24 hours after delivery. Like, chill out, woman. Like, let's see how you feel tomorrow, and then let's discuss, right? You talk more, right? The USMLEs like you talking with your patients, not just kind of like making a decision, touchdown, and move along. No. So I like option C a lot. Option D says, you concentrate on getting better and leave the insurance company to me. I'll take on the insurance companies. Many governments, administrations, political parties, many people have tried to deal with insurance companies. They've not made much progress. You, the one doctor, wants to take on the system. Have fun with that. That's wrong. Option E says, unfortunately, I have no control over the insurance company, so you had better plan on leaving tomorrow. That's very rude, right? And what if the patient is not feeling well? And you're like, hey, get out. No, you're not going to do that. So option E is wrong. All right. Question 10, which is linked to the same question. Which of the following would be the most important indication for extending this patient's hospital stay beyond 48 hours postpartum? Option A says, abdominal distension and lack of appetite at 48 hours postpartum. Option B says, lack of bowel movement postpartum. Option C says, need for nursing assistance with breastfeeding. Option D says, palpation of the uterus above the pubic symphysis for more than 48 hours postpartum. Option E says, persistence of lochia for more than 24 hours postpartum, right? So again, this is like a prognosis question in disguise, right? It's a prognosis question in disguise, right? So basically, like, this is asking, like, hey, what will make us keep this lady for more than 48 hours? Well, obviously, it will have to be something that is pretty serious, right? So option E, presence of lochia for more than 24 hours, that's ridiculous, that's wrong, right? Women can have lochia for weeks after delivery of a child. It's normal, right? Hey, that blood volume you have, of your blood volume increasing by like 50% during pregnancy, like you got to get rid of that blood somehow. Option D says, palpation of the uterus above the pubic symphysis for more than 48 hours postpartum. That's fine, right? You know, above the pubic symphysis, that's actually almost like, it's actually a good thing. It means that, wow, this woman's uterus is getting smaller and smaller, as it should, right? Because it's contracting down to its normal size after delivery, right? So that's wrong. That's a normal finding. Option C says, need for nursing assistance with breastfeeding. You can get lactation assistance outpatient. Again, the thing is, go for cost-effective options on your exams if you can, okay? Go for cost-effective options on your exams if you can, right? Like, if a patient can be treated outpatient for something, don't pick the inpatient answer. That doesn't make any sense, right? Because you're driving up the cost of healthcare, right? Option B says, lack of bowel movement postpartum. Not having a bowel movement is not a problem, right? Epidurals contain opioids, right? Those opioids can cause constipation. It's going to be fine. She's going to be okay, right? Chill out. Option A is the best answer, right? Abdominal distension and lack of appetite. So she's not eating. That's strange. Abdominal distension, that's worrisome, right? Hey, maybe the uterus is not contracting down. She could have postpartum hemorrhage, right? Or she's developing some kind of abdominal complication, right? That would be a situation where it's like, let's keep you for a bit. Let's keep you for a bit in the hospital, right? So I'm going to go with option A for question number 10 and option C for question number 9, all right? So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. Again, this is 10 questions, which is kind of my goal for this, right? But again, I hope you found this podcast to be helpful. Basically, think of these questions as a free 86 questions from the NBA Meets. They're very good. So I'm going to walk through all of them. And you see, I'm not just talking about content. I'm also talking about testing principles, right? So if you like the way I teach, you'll certainly love my classes. Like, for example, in the month of June, there's a 500 question class. It's multiple choice. Where, so 500 questions, multiple choice class, it's a 50-hour class. I go through a ton of content, a ton of test taking strategies. It's held only once a year. It's the first 2 weeks of June this year. Many people have taken that class and they found it to be extremely helpful. And it's not just that, you get a lot of supplemental material from the class, right? So, again, limited spots available for that, but that's a class that many people love, right? Like, I integrate so many things, very comprehensive coverage of the USMLE exams, right? Definitely for people taking step two or level two, step three or level three, or people taking, or people actually preparing for residency. It's actually a phenomenal course to take to pull together many things from medical school to get you very set for residency and intern year, right? They're actually people that have taken the class for that express purpose. And it will also help you with the in-training exams that you're going to be dealing with when you start residency, right? So just something to keep in mind. And then I also offer a 20-hour class. That's for step two and step three as well. And a last-minute review, that's for step two and step three as well. That's 3 hours long. And then I have classes for step one all the way to step three. I have a test-taking class. I have a biostats class. I have a social sciences and ethics class. Those are for step one to step three. And all these classes start this month, right? Actually, they start next week. The 50-hour class is first 2 weeks in June, but all these classes start next week on Monday, actually. Right? So if you're interested, shoot me an email. I can give you some more information. Again, I really make a conscious effort to go over pathophase, make integrations, teach you content, teach you test taking principles as you come through these classes. Again, many people have taken my classes and have done extremely well on their exams. I also offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE and COMLEX exams and med school exams. And I have these podcasts on Apple, Google, and Spotify. And then I have another website called DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. DivineInterventionLifeLessons.com. So many of you know I'm a Christ follower. So every week I post like one or two podcasts where from a biblical perspective, I address a life lesson. There's actually an Apple podcast associated with that called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons podcast. I have almost 400 podcasts on there, right? So thank you for listening to me today. Again, I do hope you find this podcast to be helpful. I also help with ERAS applications and mock interviews and personal statements and rec letters and things like that. So thank you for listening to me. I will see you, God willing, in episode 640. Have a wonderful day. God bless you and bye for now. Thank you.